I'll call our third and last case for today, 2012-AP-2782-CR, State v. Andre M. Shamblett. Stephen Zaleski is going to argue on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Shamblett, and Michael Sanders, Assistant Attorney General, will be arguing for the State of Wisconsin. Mr. Zaleski.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, opposing counsel, I'm Stephen Zaleski. I represent Mr. Shamblett in this case. Thank you for accepting review of the case. I think the case, the State's position based on the Weidman case, the McAllister case, Banks, the prior convictions are to be determined by the trial court at the time of sentencing, and that sentence is required to be opposed in accordance with that determination is very problematic. I think it's problematic in terms of the constitutional, statutory, procedural issues that it raises, as well as some of the absurd and unreasonable results. I like to, when I'm talking about and thinking about the case, to think of an extreme or an exaggerated example which kind of teases out these issues, and one that I've been having fun thinking of is an OWI second charge. That's a misdemeanor under the criminal.
Counsel, I wonder if you could raise that up a little bit so that we can.
Difficulty hearing.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Counsel, the podium can be raised as well as the microphone.
Judge, I'll. Is that better?
The assistant deputy marshal will help you.
There we go.
So, Judge, in my example, we can have a client who's charged with an OWI second in the criminal complaint, of course, that carries a minimum of 5 days in jail, up to 6 months. Trial counsel explains to him, based on his BAC level, he's going to get the minimum penalty, 5 days. He also tells the client, based on a county practice, you're probably going to get EMP, you're probably going to get the bracelet, you're going to serve that at home in the convenience of your house. You're really not looking at any jail. Maybe you may do 1 day in jail. There's no plea agreement. That client goes to the plea hearing. The judge, of course, does the colloquy, tells him mandatory minimum, 5 days. That's the minimum, maximum 6 months. The judge takes the plea, sets it over for sentence. Between that time and the time of sentence, the prosecutor comes and says, listen, I've gone over your client's driving history, his criminal history. It goes back over the course of his lifetime. The client's, let's say, 75 years old. The prosecutor says, well, I found 3 refusals from out of state and 2 prior convictions from out of state going back 40, 50 years. Under Weidman and McAllister and Banks, the court needs to make the determination of the prior convictions at the time of sentencing and impose a sentence in accordance with that determination. So rather than a misdemeanor second offense, your client is looking at a 7th offense, which carries a mandatory minimum in prison of 3 years. That's an entirely different situation. And under the state's theory, That can happen.
Don't you think before sentencing, though, the remedy of plea withdrawal would be a reasonable one? And the standard would be lower, so you'd be in a different position than you are now. I get what you're saying. I'm just trying to figure out what we do with your client now, that after the fact, this is all essentially over. I mean, it seems to me the remedy might be plea withdrawal. But you're kind of beyond that, since he's served his sentence, right?
Judge, in my client, that's my client's situation, that's absolutely true. I'm contemplating just the state's theory on a whole across the state, how that's unworkable.
I don't know if it's unworkable, but I mean, I'm just thinking as a trial court judge, if someone says to you, Judge, we just learned this is really a 7th offense. If I'm the judge, I don't want to pretend it's a 2nd offense if it's a 7th. I'm going to give you the chance to say, no, those aren't my convictions, or I'm not, and then weigh and balance it, and then The relief, it seems to me, would be that you'd move to withdraw your plea, and then the state could charge you with what they think you should be facing, and then you proceed forward. No? I mean, the judge can't just put blinders on and pretend it's not a seventh offense.
Well, Judge, that's true. I think what the court is getting at, under that circumstance, it's not a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea. That would be the basis for a plea withdrawal. I think in my client's situation, if we take that premise that it's not a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea, then that prevents the Court of Appeals from doing what it did in this case. Because if it's not a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea, then the court, to a PAC 7, then the Court of Appeals cannot go back and order that the judgment of conviction to a PAC 7 be imposed, and that my client be sentenced on PAC 7 penalties. If the premise is that his plea was not knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily entered to the PAC 7. So I would agree with you. I would agree with you. Because what the Court of Appeals is doing is ordering my client to go back to the trial court level, not to withdraw his plea. The defendant who gets to withdraw his plea is in an even better situation because he can still fight his case. My client can't.
Well, your client would be, then you'd be raising double jeopardy concerns, right?
Judge, we would do that. My understanding of the petition for review in this case prohibited me from making those arguments. I think that's absolutely positively correct. But under the court's suggestion, my client would be in the worst situation because he cannot withdraw his plea. He's faced with the Court of Appeals order to be sentenced on the PAC 7 penalties, which, one, as a matter of fact, he did not enter a plea to, and then as the court has suggested, well, it's not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily entered, but my guy doesn't even have the chance to withdraw the plea or fight about it. He just goes back to the trial court and gets sentenced on it.
Counsel, I'm not sure that I understood your answer to Justice Eagler in regard to why you're not arguing double jeopardy.
Judge, I would argue a double jeopardy. In fact, I argue that throughout the case, it's somewhat interesting. This was a state's appeal.
Well, wait a minute. You argued it throughout the case, but you grounded your argument here in due process, I believe.
That's correct. My understanding of the petition for review, the case wasn't accepted for review on the double jeopardy issue.
Well,
but I would certainly argue that for my client to go back before the trial court and be sentenced, again, it was subjected to multiple punishment for basically the same offense.
The reason I asked you the question is because I did just a little bit of looking, and I'm looking at the holding of State v. Comstock, COMSTOCK 168, with second. 915 at page 938, a 1992 opinion of this court, which tells us that jeopardy will attach at the moment the trial court accepts a plea of guilty or no contest, since such a plea exposes an accused to the risk of a determination of guilt. And, you know, a lot of time and a lot of ink was spent on relating the specific facts of this case and what the lawyers told the court, and the court requiring additional proof from the state. But it seems to me that a decent argument could be made that, you know, I don't know what you were, I don't recall what you were told, but our job is to decide this case. And if the court accepts the plea, as Judge Levine did here, and tells the defendant what he's going to be sentenced for, it seems to me that a very reasonable argument could be made that a double jeopardy has attached.
Judge, I would agree with that, and I did make the double jeopardy argument in my motion to dismiss at the Court of Appeals level. I made that argument in my motion to reconsider the motion to dismiss. They dismiss my motion. They dismiss the motion for reconsideration. Judge, I did brief that issue at the Court of Appeals level. The Court of Appeals felt that that argument wasn't sufficiently developed, so they rejected it. But, Judge, that was my initial thought and my initial position throughout the entire case, that double jeopardy prohibited the state from doing what it's doing. But since the Court of Appeals rejected that, Judge, I was forced to move over to the Bangert issue and argue it from a standpoint it wasn't knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily entered. And I believe the double jeopardy issue is certainly valid, and that was my first line of attack.
Well, counsel, I have in front of me an order dated November 18 granting review, and it has two issues stated, and it says the parties should note that the second issue set forth above is hereby modified from that stated in the petition for review to omit the reference to double jeopardy protections. Is that the order you got?
Correct.
Okay. So we told you, don't argue double jeopardy.
Correct. So
that's why you're not arguing double jeopardy.
No, that's correct.
And in your petition for review, however, you set that out as a reviewable issue. Is that right?
Judge, that's correct. In my petition for review, I set forth a number of issues. I thought the case presented a host of interesting issues. The double jeopardy one was certainly one of them. That was my initial line of defense from the get-go of the case. In terms of why it was not flushed out before this court, I was instructed not to by the order. Otherwise, I would have. But my arguments were made throughout the case, and the court sees them in the petition for review as well. So I would agree with the judge. That was my first line of attack.
Counselor, if we were to agree that because of the uncertainty about the period of incarceration that might be applied, your client's plea was not entered knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and then remanded it to the trial court to let him withdraw his plea, would that satisfy your client's interest?
Judge, I think I think at this point the double jeopardy argument would come into play, so that wouldn't work. I don't think that would work, Judge, because he's been convicted for this offense.
Right.
He's been sentenced. Yep. He's actually served the sentence. He's out.
So withdrawing the plea doesn't give him any relief.
No, withdrawing the plea does not give him a relief, and I believe it's barred by double jeopardy. And so he's really in a fix.
So he's barred by double jeopardy. Why? Because he served his sentence. Generally, when we let people withdraw their plea, they don't get into double jeopardy problems.
Well, I guess to the extent that he was convicted on a plea, we would be sending him back to the trial court to be prosecuted for the same offense after he's been convicted of it.
But your problem here, or a problem, is in most criminal cases where there's been a conviction, the defendant appeals, and that waives any problem about double jeopardy because you're saying it was an error, and you're not saying it can't be done again, right? In this case, you didn't appeal originally. The state appealed. Isn't that right?
That is exactly correct, Judge.
And so you were dragged up, and one of your arguments was they can't do that to you, that if they were going to appeal, they had to do an intermediate appeal as soon as they got bad news, that is, they as being the state. Right?
Exactly correct.
But the Court of Appeals did not buy that.
Exactly correct.
All right. And the Court of Appeals said this decision of the trial court was adverse to the state, therefore, and the state could therefore appeal. That's why you get into this double jeopardy issue, because you're not the one that insisted that there was error.
That's exactly correct, Judge. So my client was not asking to withdraw his plea. Then if we get into sending it back under a plea withdrawal, framework, then my client gets into issues of, hey, I had a benefit of a plea agreement here. If you send it back to the trial court level, my client arguably could be in a worse position because as part of his plea agreement, a battery to prisoner case was dismissed, an obstructing charge was dismissed, an HCA enhancer was dismissed. So then you get into the issue of, well, he's facing even greater exposure. And he wasn't asking to withdraw his plea, and it would create an odd situation of the court vacating his plea and subjecting him to an even worse situation.
Well, but counsel, if we're back to due process, as apparently we are, I'm looking at a copy of the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form that your client's attorney at trial went over with him. And it does set out under the third section of the first page labeled understandings. It's very, very brief. It's the standard language. I understand that the judge is not bound by any plea agreement. And then here's the part that I just want to tell you. The maximum potential penalty that's listed out there is $25,000 fine and 10 years imprisonment, which is the maximum for the seven offense. And so, and also I have a copy of the portion of the transcript where the prosecutor is setting out the terms of the plea agreement, where he had struck an agreement with your client's trial attorney, where they both agreed they would leave the question of what number offense it was open for a different day, and your client's trial counsel did advise the court that he had gone over the maximum potential penalties that his client understood. So how is it that there is a violation of due process there?
Okay, Judge, very good. The plea questionnaire, I am aware of that argument, Judge. It does set forth the maximum penalty, but importantly, Judge, the plea questionnaire does not set forth the mandatory minimum, which would be 3 years in prison. And I believe that's under the Maurer case that I cite in my brief. The defendant needs to know if there's a mandatory minimum that he would be facing. And the plea questionnaire is deficient because it does not reference that. In fact, Judge, the plea questionnaire references the wrong minimum. It references 6 months in jail when that's not what it would be for a seventh. It would be 3 years in prison.
See, I kind of see this case as a, you know, when you have especially out-of-state convictions, the state has to prove that those convictions belong to that particular defendant. Here the trial court make the determination that I'm only going to find that you've proven these priors, essentially. So why isn't this just a review of whether that discretionary determination was within the province of the trial court? It's almost like it's sort of a finding. You haven't proven these to the requisite standard. And then the court proceeded and sentenced your client on the convictions the court thought were proven.
Judge, I did make arguments based on that line of thinking in my Court of Appeals brief, and I did address the trial court's discretion to put parameters on the state's ability to come forth timing-wise and make those arguments. Ultimately, those arguments were rejected, and I think ultimately it puts my client in a situation where he's being sent back to the trial court to be sentenced on a plea, on a charge that he didn't enter a plea of guilty or no contest to, and he did not agree to face those penalties. So I think, Judge, although it did begin with those types of arguments that the trial court does have this discretion to make this assessment, once the Court of Appeals entered the order that it did, it elevated the nature of the issues to a more constitutional perspective. And that's why we have the arguments before this court that we do. But I did make perhaps the more discretionary arguments regarding what the trial court can do in terms of deciding the prior convictions at the trial court level in my court of appeals brief. Judge, getting back to your question, the court has referenced the statements made by a trial counsel, and I understand that that's very clear in the record.
Please let me interject, because I want to correct something. You saw me look up, I think, when you said that the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form contained the incorrect minimum sentence of 6 months, and when it's 3 years. And I was confused by that because I thought I missed something when you said that. But actually, the plea questionnaire contains no mandatory minimum. It was Mr. Dwyer at the sentencing hearing who, when asked if the prosecutor had correctly stated the agreement, said yes, and then he, at the appendix, respondent's appendix 104, page 4 of the transcript, the minimum jail will be 6 months jail. So it's something that defense counsel said at the what turned into a plea hearing, and then the prosecutor on the next page corrected the record by saying, and just to interject, just to clarify, I think what Mr. Dwyer meant was a Class H felony, which is a fifth or sixth, and then a Class G felony representing the alternative potentials, which is a seventh, and it's a minimum initial confinement in prison of 3 years. So it was stated on the record, at least.
Judge, you are exactly correct. That did happen. The problem with that assessment, Judge, is this. Basically, the court cannot rely on trial counsel's statements in court to infer knowledge and understanding by the defendant. And I would cite the case of State versus Brown. There's a lot of things that go on in the courtroom between the lawyers and the judge. A lot of talk. And a lot of time the defendant isn't listening. He's zoning out, thinking of other things. But when we get to the plea colloquy, very, very important, because that's where the trial court needs to ascertain whether the defendant really understands what's going on. So very important. Under 97108, the trial court needs to have a personal colloquy with the defendant to make sure that he's listening. And in that colloquy, the trial court goes through the elements. He goes through the penalties. And so Brown tells us, and I would quote from that, the Bangert requires independent verification of defense counsel's assertions. And Brown further states that a court cannot rely very heavily upon mere statements from defense counsel. And Judge Fine, I think the most important thing it states is that knowledge like understanding cannot be inferred. And so, Judge, you are right, the transcript does reflect that, but what we would be doing in that situation is inferring from trial counsel statements that Chambliss had that understanding, which is not correct. And that's why we have the plea colloquy where the trial court judge can specifically ask the defendant, do you understand the penalties? And the defendant will answer. And that's why we have that. And that's also the importance of having a Bangert evidentiary hearing where the state can flesh that out and get into those issues. Here we don't have the benefit of an evidentiary hearing, so the record is very, very sparse as to Chambliss's knowledge and understanding. And the colloquy that we do have, Judge, is only on the PAC 6. So in the colloquy that we do have, Chambliss states nothing about his understanding of the PAC 7 penalties. It only references his understanding of the 6.
Do I understand you correctly that the defendant entered a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea to a 6 offense PAC?
Correct, Judge.
And so how do you want an opinion to be written? That we should just ignore any errors that may have occurred, or what?
Well, Judge, I think the opinion should clarify that the state, it's a bad idea for practitioners and the state and the trial courts to take a variable contingent plea. I think that would be instructive. Initially, I thought it was a very interesting issue as to whether the state could even appeal under these circumstances. That issue wasn't accepted for review, so I don't know if the court's opinion could contemplate that. But I think the court's opinion needs to reverse the order of the Court of Appeals, ordering my client to go back to the trial court where the judgment of conviction would be amended. The judgment of conviction can't be amended to reflect a seventh when he's only pled to a sixth. And the Court of Appeals ordered that the trial court impose sentence in accordance with his seventh penalties has to be reversed too. And that's at a minimum what the order should reflect. It should specifically reverse the Court of Appeals order. But I thought when I got involved with the appeal that it did present a host of interesting issues in terms of the state's ability to appeal the case. And then certainly the idea of doing a contingent or variable plea. I think the court can contemplate situations across the state where the parties aren't sure whether it's a third or fourth or fifth, so they just take a variable plea and they end up having they have the judge inform the defendant of four different sets of maximum penalties, maybe four different sets of minimum penalties. It could be a misdemeanor. It could be a felony. Even on a fourth judge, that could be a misdemeanor, could be a felony. Even on a fourth, it could be 1 year in jail maximum. It could be, I believe it could be a six-year prison sentence. So I thought the court may look at that because I have seen that a couple of times where parties attempt to propose a variable contingent plea and it doesn't work out. My time is up, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your materials are on the podium.
Mr. Sanders.
May it please the court. The state asked this court to make two holdings. The first is that just like in cases in which a defendant is found guilty at a trial, when a person pleads guilty or no contest to an OWI or PAC, the number of convictions has to be counted after the plea is entered and at or before the time of sentencing. And as a second holding, we ask that the court conclude that the Court of Appeals correctly reversed and remanded this case to the circuit court so that it can impose sentence for a seventh offense because he has seven convictions that have to be counted under the statute. I think this case really, well, this case comes down to how the statutes work. Under 343.307 and 346.65, the trial court is required to count the convictions and to impose sentence based on the total number. That has to be made at the time of sentencing or at least after the time of that the plea was entered or the jury or court found the defendant guilty of the underlying crime.
Counselor, if we do that, how do we permit a defendant who at the trial court level is told by the trial judge, this is a sixth, and he says, yes, I'm pleading to a sixth, how do we then conclude his plea was entered knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily if we wait until sentencing to make these determinations?
Well, this is a strange case because of how it worked out, where the defense attorney said, this is a plea, it's not clear which it's going to be to. Here is the least he could get, here's the most he can get, we're not sure how we're going to do this. He wants to plead. And he was going to plead either to a sixth or a seventh, and then they were going to determine whether the one prior counted. The judge, though, did say, I'm taking a plea to a sixth, I'm not taking it. He was entirely wrong, because the state proved that prior twice. And it's very clear. The Court of Appeals found that the state had definitively proved it.
All of that may be true. I'm not sure. Concerned about that part of the Court of Appeals opinion. What I am concerned with is whether the plea was knowing and intelligent and voluntary under these circumstances. And we always look at the totality of the circumstances. And here we got a judge saying, I'm sorry, that proof isn't good enough. I'll take a plea to a six, but I'm not taking one to a seven. So how do you make me think or comfortable with the idea that the plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary? Because that's where I'm having trouble.
Well, on the facts of this case, what the defendant argued in the Court of Appeals was that the problem was that he did not have notice of the potential penalties. The Court of Appeals found that on the facts of this case, even though the judge said, I am accepting a plea to a sixth, he knew what the maximum penalties could be if it were later to be determined that it was going to be a seventh. He knew that the state was going to appeal that the state did not agree, and he knew that the state had proof, and it was just a matter of whether the judge was going to accept the proof. So on the facts of that case, he knew what the maximum penalty was. I want to make clear, I would expect that if this is sent back to the trial court and he were to move to withdraw his plea, I have no doubt he would be allowed to withdraw his plea. Because on the facts, again, the judge did say, I'm not accepting it for a seventh, I am for a sixth. I would think that when it's sent back and the sentence is vacated, he would be under the pre-sentence plea withdrawal standard, which is a fair and just reason, and I would have to think that the trial court would find that he has a fair and just reason and would allow him to withdraw his plea.
Thank you. Are you saying that you are acknowledging that the plea was not knowing and intelligently made? It sounds like you're awfully close to it, if not doing it. You indicated, and this is what I heard essentially. I have no doubt that if he goes back and makes a motion to withdraw his plea, it will be granted. I mean, that sounded to me like you're saying that the plea was not knowing and voluntary, or at least he could meet the burden of showing that it was not knowing and voluntary.
All I'm actually saying is okay. That when it goes back, he wouldn't have any problem, I don't think, showing a fair and just reason to allow him to withdraw his plea. I don't think he'd even have to show that it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. He could just show that under these circumstances, it's not fair not to allow him to do it.
Fair enough. And I appreciate that response. But then I have a follow-up. 97108.
Yes.
A. 1A. It says that the court shall do the following. Mm-hmm. You know it by heart, I'm sure. Address the defendant personally and determine that the plea is made voluntarily with an understanding of the nature of the charge and the potential punishment if convicted. I interpret that last phrase and the potential punishment if convicted to be of the charge, the potential punishment of the charge. It says, with an understanding of the nature of the charge and the potential punishment. And I would say it means of the charge as opposed to and the potential punishment of other conceivable charges. So I think 971-08-1A requires a personal determination that the plea is made voluntarily with an understanding of the nature of the charge and the potential punishment of the charge if convicted. Do you agree or disagree with my reading that the potential punishment refers to of the charge convicted and not does not refer to other potential punishments of other charges?
In the drunk driving context, it's a strange law. The way it works, and I will get to this. I just need to get to something else first if I can. The case that the opposing counsel brought up was a person who wanted to plead to a OWI second, and then sometime between the entry of the plea and the timing of the sentence, it was found that he or she had five other priors. The way that would work if the person had been tried is between the trial and the sentencing, the judge would count them, and it would have to, and then would be required under the statute to impose sentence for a seventh offense. There isn't any way to not do it. It just has to happen. What the state's arguing is that in a plea context, it has to work the same way.
Why?
Because under 346.65 and 343.307, when the judge imposes sentence, he or she has to count how many convictions there are and has to impose sentence for that number. In this case, it's strange because at the time of the plea, it appeared to the judge that there were only six. But it's now clear that there were seven.
Well, why can't you have it both ways? That is, that the defendant pled to six. The defendant was advised, take my example, we don't want to fight about what he was advised. And it was advised as to six, pled to six. Thinks that his maximum sentence is according to six. Now we get to sentencing. And the judge has the responsibility to determine what number of offense this is and to sentence him accordingly.
Yep.
Okay. The judge can do that, but the circuit court has a little problem. And the little problem is that the plea is suspect. That's the problem in this case, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say the sentence is okay for seven, right?
Sure.
The state had the proof, et cetera. So now what you got, the sentence can be for seven, but there's no basis upon which to do that sentencing because the plea colloquy is bad, because he is charged with six, pleads to six, is advised as to six. So the judge can't just sentence him on seven because the basis isn't there. That's how I hear the defendant's argument. And I agree that if there was a trial, you wouldn't have that problem. Because in the trial, you don't ask the jury how many prior offenses he had. You only say, is he guilty of, and whatever the charge is in this particular case of not having of going up on the, what do you call it, the EAC, or that he's intoxicated otherwise, right? So the jury verdict is terrific. It has absolutely no problems. Therefore, the judge can sentence him appropriately. The problem in this case is that plea any good?
Well, and that's why I think that the result would be he could move to withdraw his plea. And that the court has to, in almost every case, is going to grant it and let him start over.
Why don't you just concede that here?
Because it's up to the trial court to make that determination. I don't think there's any chance that the court isn't going to make it, but I don't know that it's the role of the state to make that determination here.
But the state is conceding, in effect. The state is conceding, in effect, there's a defect here in the plea colloquy.
Yes, because the court only counted six and told him, I'm only counting six, when the court should have counted seven and said, I'm counting seven, yes.
And so you're saying you can't take an appeal on that. What you got to do is just go to the court and get a withdrawal of the plea.
You can't take an appeal on?
On the case anymore. He can't appeal.
In the Court of Appeals, that was raised, whether the state had proved this,
right,
in the state's appeal. Mm-hmm. And the Court of Appeals found that the state proved it one time. I think if you look at the record closely, it's very clear that the state proved it twice.
Are you really saying that the state could charge a defendant with a misdemeanor, and if they later find out before sentencing that it should have been a felony, that the person can be sentenced for a felony?
I'm saying
and
that...
And they just, even though the jury found OWI second, the court can just amend the conviction and sentence as if it were an OWI 10th?
Well, I don't think the jury
But the charges and the penalties and the whole choice to go to trial, mm-hmm, the person made based upon thinking it was,
yes,
a second,
yes,
not a felony.
Yes.
And you're saying that,
yes,
really? You,
yes,
think the court can just amend that, convict him of a felony and sentence him for a felony even though he was convicted of and made every choice to go to
convicted.
Trial?
He's convicted of OWI. The priors are determined later. And that's clear under Banks, McAllister, Spaeth, Weideman, Mackey. All of them say the same thing.
Did that work for a first offense, too, where the legal standard is even different?
There could certainly be some strange cases where you could have a first that becomes a tenth. And I think in every case, they would just reopen or allow the defendant to withdraw or do something.
Here's part of what I struggle with. The trial court judge does have to determine whether or not you've met your burden to prove that there are prior convictions.
Yes.
It happens, and sometimes it's trickier, especially when you have out-of-state convictions and people purge their records and they don't save them or different things happen or someone,
sure,
raises an issue that the standard there is different than the standard in Wisconsin.
Yes.
You know, and then you count them up and you the person knows what they're pleading to and you sentence them,
yes,
based on that. I always thought that was something that held some water, that it was an exercise of discretion as to whether the state met its burden in that regard. And here I kind of read the record as if the state or the judge is saying, look, I'm going to give you this period of time to prove this, but right now you really haven't met that burden. You don't read this that way?
Well, what occurred is the state provided proof of that prior in January, and it showed his name, which county, what he was convicted of, how much time he lost his license, all of those things. For whatever reason, the judge didn't agree that showed those things. So the judge told the prosecutor he could still prove that. And at the time that they got there for the plea hearing, it appeared that he was telling him you can prove that any time up until sentencing, because that's how it works under all of those cases I just named. Then at some point he said, I don't think you can prove it anymore. It's too late. I'm not going to accept any more proof, and I'm going to take a plea to a sixth, which I think is wrong across the board because he could have proved it. He did prove it. The judge erred and wouldn't take it. So I think where this comes down at some point is in a case like this where the judge erred. He made a discretionary call, which was wrong. What can the state do? And if the state can't appeal, does the defendant then escape the conviction and the sentence for what he did? In this case, he clearly has seven. So the question is, because of a court error, is he not going to serve the time that the legislature has said anyone who has seven has to serve?
Mr. Sanders, last term we had a case, State versus Williams,
okay,
in which we interpreted the,
yeah,
seventh, eighth, and ninth. And the majority of the court said there's a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years. But we certainly understood that some people disagreed with that, that the statute, we said the statute was ambiguous, and in fact that quite a few defendants had actually not received the mandatory minimum sentence. Could, after that decision, could the government have gone back and imposed the mandatory minimum sentence on all those who didn't get it?
Not in this case, you don't mean. You mean in other cases. I don't know. That's a good question.
Okay.
I guess I would think that if that's what was required under the statute, I don't know why they couldn't, but I haven't given this any thought.
If you're saying the remedy here for the defendant is to withdraw his plea.
That would be one thing he could do. He could try to do.
But I don't think he wants to withdraw his plea.
I'm almost certain he doesn't want to because he drove at .084. He drove. He was above .02. He had more than three priors. He's not going to contest anything as far as I know because when he pled, he acknowledged everything that it took to convict him of a PAC .02. The only thing he wanted to challenge was whether one prior was in existence. The Court of Appeals has found that it is. So he can, I mean, he's supposed to be sentenced for a seventh because the state proved everything necessary to have a sentence for a seventh. He can withdraw his plea if he wants, but ultimately.
It seems to me here, from your position, we are being asked to either accept what the Court of Appeals said. We're sending this back, amend the judgment, and have a new sentence, irrespective of what the defendant wants to do. Or we're sort of going to force the defendant to withdraw his plea.
The court did say in a footnote that just as any other defendant who is where the state has proven a certain number of priors, he would have an opportunity to show that one or more of the priors aren't real. So if his claim, which his claim in this case is that the conviction from Illinois is not him, it's his cousin, if he can prove that, then he goes back to where he is now. He would have that chance. But since chances are he can't prove that because it's probably not true, then he ends up with a seventh because he's got seven. If he wants to move to withdraw his plea, he can. I doubt if he would, in part because the state proved everything it has to prove, and because to get him to plead, the state also dropped three other charges, which I believe would have carried a total of 12 years and $20,000. So I'm guessing he's not going to move to withdraw his plea and have those reinstated. But that has to be his option. I don't think there is any other option because the way that 346.65 and 343.307 read, the court is required to impose sentence based on how many convictions he's got. He's got seven. What he's asking for is that if I have this right, he's saying that once the trial court makes a determination of priors, that locks it in. He has a due process right, and it doesn't matter what else happens. That's it. And in this case, it's clear that what the court did was wrong. So his argument is that the state cannot appeal that as of right. It could try to petition for leave to appeal, but it only has 2 weeks to do that. And the court could say no. And then it's over. And a person who may have 10 priors, if the judge finds two, he's going to be sentenced for a third.
couldn't the state have said, we're withdrawing offer of a plea?
If you read the transcript closely, the judge, I think, made that pretty hard, where it was asking, why does the state care so much? Why does the state want to do this? Wouldn't it make more sense to just do this? It's not fair for the defendant to wait to find out how many priors he has. I mean, I guess the prosecutor could have said, Judge, I don't want to do this. But I think if you read the transcript pretty closely, it's a pretty tough thing to have done. And instead, what he did was say, let's do what the judge wants to do, even though it's wrong, and appeal later. And that's where we are now. And the Court of Appeals found that the court was wrong and that it should have been a 7th. So at some point, that, you know, I just don't know how else this could work when the court errs. It shouldn't be that the defendant gets a free drunk driving because the court fails to count it. There's got to be some way that the state can appeal. And, I mean, if in the same kind of a circumstance, if the defendant pleads and at the time they only know of one prior, so they go in thinking it's two. But after he pleads, the court holds it over, and it turns out he has 8 more. The court has to impose sentence for a 10th. And there's certainly no public policy reason that the judge wouldn't, because it's pretty clear that the goal is to make repeat drunk drivers serve the time that they have. So what you would logically do is allow him to withdraw his plea.
What do we do with this potential double jeopardy? Now, the way that the Court of Appeals fashioned a remand, there's no retrial, it's just, there's no re-prosecution, there's just an entry, an amendment of judgment of conviction, and entry of a sentence commensurate with the amended judgment of conviction. But when you then toss in the possibility the case is going to be reopened, admittedly only if the defendant asks to withdraw the plea, it gets to be a bit of a quagmire, it appears to me, and I don't know what, if anything, happens to a potential double jeopardy issue.
Well, that was raised 3 times in the Court of Appeals, in a motion to dismiss the state's appeal, then in a motion for reconsideration of the Court of Appeals order denying the motion to dismiss, and then again in the Court of Appeals. And I have briefed it 3 times. I don't have much. I've got my brief in the Court of Appeals in front of me, where I cited the Manji case, Manji v. California, which said that in general, sentencing is not subject to double jeopardy issues.
That's
so what I argued was that in this case, all he pled guilty to really was he operated with a prohibited alcohol concentration above 0.02 because he had 3 or more priors. He didn't contest any of that. The actual number of convictions that were going to be counted at sentencing is determined later, and that really those are not elements of the crime. So I wasn't asking the court to reopen so that he could be charged again.
That's right,
I was
you
saying.
Aren't. I mean, in fact, it's tailor-made. You don't want to, because under your argument, if you did, then it would be double prosecution.
But
double
that's
jeopardy.
Not what
no.
we're talking about here.
So
we are only talking sentencing.
Only sentencing.
He has to be sentenced for a 7th. He's got 7. The statute says 7, so all we have to do is vacate the sentence, and it's a 7th.
Well, it seems so simple. But
the court 3 times ruled that it is, and this court chose not to take it on that ground.
Maybe the state should be appealing these errors that they took to the Court of Appeals after the plea rather than waiting for sentencing.
Well, after the plea, we don't have a final order. And the Knapp case, State v. Knapp in the Court of Appeals, says that.
Yeah. You don't think you could get a discretionary appeal from the Court of Appeals?
We could try, but then every time we would have to do that.
Be trying it again. Yeah.
You know, one thing that I wanted to bring up was the idea of what the defendant is arguing, really, is that the priors have to be found after the after a verdict comes in, if it's a trial, but pre-plea, if it's a plea. But then you get the case where the defendant goes to trial and during the trial pleads. And so somehow the state has to prove the priors right then with the jury there and then would have to give the defendant a chance to prove that those priors aren't real while the trial's going on. It can't work. The only logical way is to read 346.65 and 343.307 as they read. It's not any different if it's a trial or a plea. In both cases, the judge has to find the number of convictions at the time of sentencing. I don't think they can be read any other way. And once that's clear, all we're really trying to do is determine how to make that work in the case of a plea where the trial judge errs.
Well, the problem with the plea that you don't have with the trial is the knowing and intelligent and voluntary act of the defendant that gives up his rights to a trial. So if you have a trial that starts and it ends up with a plea, I guess depending on how much guidance this case gives, you could certainly have the judge say, you know, if you want a plea, you're going to plea and tell him what the maximum is, and until I know, you should plan on it being the maximum. They still have to prove it, but if that's what it comes down to, that's what you're pleading to.
Well, that would be a good call. And in this case, had the judge done that and said, for the time being, I will accept your plea, and I will assume that the state has proven all these.
Yeah.
You have a chance to show it's not true.
Yeah.
And if that happens, then we can adjust.
Yeah.
But you would still have the problem where if after that happens, the state then says, I've got six more. And the defendant didn't know about them. And it's very clear under Spaeth and Weideman and all those cases that in a trial, the state can prove them any time up until sentencing.
Right.
And
I,
if at that point, you don't want to let the prosecutor sandbag and then say, oh, I've got six more. So what happens then is the defendant has a chance to show it's either not him or there is some problem or to challenge them or to withdraw his plea.
You know, these cases are hard enough when we stay in the moment than when we go into these other things that maybe we'll never have to meet. But I see what you're saying.
But I think the only logical way to do this is to read the statutes the way that they read and say that it doesn't say anything different if it's a plea or a trial. Under both of those statutes, the judge has to impose sentence on the number of convictions at the time of sentencing. And the goal, I think, should be how does the court get there? So that's how it works. And if that means you get to withdraw your plea, okay. If it means that the trial judge should always say the maximum possible sentence depending on how many have been alleged, okay. I don't know. But that has to be the outcome, I think, or else you're saying that the statutes don't say what they say. Mm-hmm. Or that they have to somehow be read in a way, in a plea context, that's not the same as in a trial context, when there's nothing in the statutes that would say that that's how it works.
Is there any ability of a prosecutor to plea bargain down a seventh to a fifth? None.
No. Then I don't know how to say it. The Neil Wayne case, something along those lines, any 08-O-U-A-N-E or something along those lines, the prosecutor has to tell the court about at a sentencing hearing, the prosecutor is required to give the court all relevant in information. And so if they're priors, the prosecutor has to give them to the court. And the way the statute reads, and Banks and McAllister and every other case, the court has to find them if there's proof of them and then has to impose sentence for them. So I think they're both without any chance to do anything different. That's why this is not like a repeater under 939.62, where it has to be alleged up front, and you can plea bargain those. And in this case, he did. But you can't plea bargain away any of the priors.
Thank you. James Prosser.
If you have a defendant where there's no disagreement
there's a seventh conviction. But one conviction lower than seven is from Illinois. And right before sentencing, the state just doesn't have documentation of that sixth offense. What happens then?
Then he's going to be sentenced for six. Unless the prosecutor asks the court to hold over sentencing and the court agrees. But at some point, if the judge is going to impose sentence and you've only got proof of five priors, then it's a sixth.
That's true whether it's a guilty plea.
Does the court have to say, oh, yeah, we'll give you more time?
I would assume that's a discretionary matter for the court. I don't know of a case saying that. I know in the, I think it was the Weideman case, the court said that there shouldn't be any reason to have to set it over because the state has plenty of time in most cases between the time of the trial in that case and the sentencing, and the defendant should have plenty of time. So I think what they were more concerned about is if they got to the sentencing hearing and the state had produced proof and the defendant hadn't had a chance to address it, then they would hold it over typically. But I don't know for sure if a judge would if the state said, well, I think we can prove it, but I don't have it yet. I would think that the judge should, since the public policy is very clear in the drunk driving statutes and the cases, that the goal is to impose sentence for the right number. And if it seems that the state is about to prove a sixth prior, logically, I think the court would probably say, okay, then you've got a couple of days or something to prove the sixth prior.
In Justice Prosser's example, regardless of whether it's a jury trial or a plea, and there's a plea to seven, state can't prove the seven, you said that the sentencing should be based on the six, right? Now, who's going to object to that? Not the defendant, because he'll get a better deal, right? Not the state, because it's the state's error. Do you know what I mean?
Who's going to object to the sentence being for a sixth when the state can only prove five priors and a sixth?
Yeah.
Right. I would doubt if there would be anything. I don't think there would be any grounds for appeal for either party.
That's right.
Because in a drunk driving case, again, all the state is proving is you operated while under the influence. So there's really no appeal because if that was proved either to a jury or by plea, all that's left is to determine how many convictions there are under 343, 307, and 346.65. If it's six, it's six. If it's seven, it's seven. So I don't think anyone could appeal.
And the defendant got a better deal than what he pled, the charge that he pled to, which was seven. So he's not going to complain.
If it in this case, you mean?
No, or in Justice Prosser's case.
Oh, where the state wasn't able to prove it. Well, no, he wouldn't want to appeal because it's only going to be a six. I would argue that it doesn't matter. Well, if in a plea context, it's not exactly the same. If they told him it's going to be a seventh, turns out it's a sixth, I guess he could move to withdraw his plea if he really wanted to. I can't imagine what circumstance that would be where that would make sense, but right. It's conceivable, I guess.
Everything's conceivable.
But in general, I guess I would assume that neither side's going to appeal because he got a better deal than he thought he was getting, and the state can't prove the prior, so what's it going to appeal if it truly can't prove the prior, which is not like this case where the state proved it twice.
What's the maximum sentence he could have gotten for a seventh?
Just one second, please.
I know there's a minimum involved, but...
For a seventh, the maximum is 10 years and $25,000.
And what was he told at the plea hearing that he could face?
By the judge?
Yes.
I would have to find...
6 years.
which is the sentence for a...
I don't know. Six years plus 4 years for a prior felony conviction, right? And didn't the plea form say 10 years and $25,000? The plea questioner?
I'm sorry. I don't have it in front of me, and I do not recall.
Okay.
I don't know. I know that they did drop the repeaters under 39.62. There were two of those, and they dropped them both as part of the plea bargain.
I'm just looking at the plea questionnaire where it says maximum's 10 years, 25,000.
Which would be the sentence for a Class G felony, which is what he actually should have had.
That's why I'm wondering what he was warned versus what the maximum would be. At that point, he
was warned, right, that he could get 10 years and a $25,000 fine, which is what the maximum sentence was if the court had counted the prior that it didn't count and had called this a seventh. The maximum would have been 10 years and $25,000 once the repeaters and the other charges were dismissed.
Okay.
Sir.
Thank
Are there
you.
Any further questions? Because my light's been on for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. You. And Mr. Zaleski, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Just to follow up on Justice Ziegler's question and point, he was advised in the colloquy that the maximum penalty was 6 years in prison. That's what's the... operative issue in the case. He was advised in the colloquy that it was 6 years in prison, three in, three out. That's what he was told in the colloquy. The plea questionnaire references the 10-year max, which does pertain to Class G, and that would lend itself to an argument that, well, you knew what the max was on a Class G felony. That's true. But the problem with that, Judge, is that plea questionnaire didn't advise him of the mandatory and presumptive minimum, which is arguably more important, and that was 3 years. So the plea questionnaire doesn't really help. It's not instructive. And then when you get into the plea colloquy, it only told him 6 years in prison. And to confirm, Judge, the HCA enhancer, which added additional confinement, that was dismissed. I think the state's concessions here really required the court to simply reverse the Court of Appeals decision. I think the state concedes that the conviction cannot be vacated because of double jeopardy grounds. I would agree with that. It can't be vacated. And then the state's concession that, well, it's not a knowing, intelligently, involuntary plea prevents it from being remanded for sentencing, which is what the Court of Appeals said. The Court of Appeals said, we're simply going to amend the judgment conviction and then sentence him on the higher charge. Well, you can't do that if the plea is not knowing intelligently and voluntarily entered.
So I'm not quite sure the state conceded that. Is that what you heard the state? I heard it concede that upon remand, if a motion were made, that there would be a fair and just reason.
Maybe. I think...
not sure. That's why I'm asking. Are you sure that's what the state did?
Judge, I would say that same fair and just reason would be that it wasn't a knowing, intelligently, involuntarily entered plea. If we have that, we don't even need to get to that far. Because if it was not a knowing, intelligently, involuntarily entered plea, the Court of Appeals order simply needs to be reversed. Because it cannot be the basis then for a higher conviction to a Class G felony. It cannot be the basis to have him sentenced on the higher penalties.
And the context that discussion came up in was exactly as you just said. It was based on the higher sentence. And that, I assume, is why you would take the position that the plea was not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily entered.
Correct, Judge.
Well, what about how do you respond to the state's argument that the number of priors is not an element of the offense charge, that the state pretty much has to prove two things, and neither of which include the number of priors. So if that's their burden at jury trial, and the state's representative points out that it is not unheard of fairly common for a jury trial to turn into a plea hearing. So under those circumstances, could the plea be taken and sentencing be put off for a later date? The judge is going to want to take the plea because the judge is not going to want to dismiss the jury without a plea. That's my observation, and it's also my experience. But then at the time of the jury trial, the state might not necessarily have, in my experience, it usually does. But maybe they would anticipate a sentencing date down the road, or a pre-sentence investigation report yields additional information. So what would be the defect in that scenario where the time and date set for a jury trial turns into a plea, the judge accepts the plea using the elements that are the essential ones. Mm-hmm. Well, they're either elements or they're not. He takes the plea to the elements, enters the judgment of guilt, and says, we're going to order a PSI or we're going to take some time, and 4 weeks down the road we're going to have sentencing, and lo and behold, 4 weeks later, they turn up two new priors. What happens in that scenario?
Judge, I don't think that can happen. My question would be, what would the judge instruct the defendant as to the maximum penalties? The judge couldn't do that. In order to take the plea, the judge has to advise the defendant as to the penalties. In that example, the court would not be able to advise the defendant of the penalty.
I guess the court would have the option of advising as to the highest potential maximum penalty for prohibited alcohol concentration or OWI.
Judge, I think that takes us to this very same position, that the court would have to make some sort of determination. And what I hear the court contemplate is, well, maybe the court could, as the state suggests, give some sort of variable or contingent range, which
I
think is unworkable.
And to bring it closer to home, to this case, that's exactly what the attorneys were asking the court to do in this case. Both attorneys, and the defense attorney did not change his stance until the circuit court judge started expressing reservations about the plan and frustration at the amount of time that it had taken the prosecution to come up with the evidence of the Illinois convictions. And then sort of, as I read it, it was a response to the judge's comments that the defense attorney did what a good defense attorney would do, recognize that the tide has turned in his client's favor, and run with it. So both attorneys were asking the court to do exactly what I've just set out.
Well, I don't think Mr. Chambliss ever consented or agreed that it was a seventh offense. He never did that. And as I understand, trial counsel.
I agree with you. That was the purpose for the alternative sentencing recommendation.
Well, Judge, I would say in this case, his theoretical knowledge of the penalties for a seventh or higher don't matter because he only entered a plea to the sixth. And I think the judge, anytime he takes a plea, he needs to make sure the defendant knows the maximum and the presumptive minimum. You know, I'm thinking of the Bollig case. I think it's Bangert. Some really good language in that case regarding the trial court needs to inform the defendant of the direct consequences of his plea, and the direct consequences immediately and automatically flow from the entry of the plea. So if we're going to make a determination as to the prior sometime down the road, that doesn't satisfy Bollig and Bangert because there's an intervening subsequent event. So the defendant's always going to be able to come back and challenge that.
It's not such a bright line test because this court has held that where the explained sentence is higher but not substantially higher than the actual sentence, that passes the due process test.
Judge, that's exactly correct. I believe that's a cross case. I believe that was your decision, Judge, your opinion. I think the interesting thing in that case, Judge, was that I believe the issue was the defendant was misadvised that it was a 40-year felony.
That what?
That was a 40-year felony?
Yes.
40 years, and it was actually a 30 years. And I think the determinative factor in that case was the court was able to point out, well, if you pled to a 40-year, implicitly in agreeing to face a 40, you agreed to face a 30.
I didn't mean to make you go down this road. I was just saying it's not quite that bright a line, but it's impressive you're as familiar with the case as you are.
Judge, my red light is on.
Red light is on. Are there any other questions? If not, I want to thank on behalf of the court, Attorneys Zaleski and Sanders, for their arguments once again on Bangert and on OWI. We have brought in a different fact pattern than we've seen before. That concludes our hearing on 2012 AP 2782 CR, State versus Chambliss. The court is in recess until tomorrow, when we will have three more oral arguments, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:20. We are in recess.